are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 2nd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Harvey Kaye on his book, The Fight for Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Also on the program, a lot of the drama just went out of the question of the Iran agreement. Meanwhile, a lonely, what is it? Our lonely eyes turn to you, Mitt Romney. Will you come back? Maybe. Hillary Clinton announces a big anti-drug treatment initiative, part of a criminal reform package. Meanwhile, that Kentucky clerk refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Apparently, not so morally pure herself. I mean, careful I don't even know. I can't say any of the idioms today. Something about judge, speck, lest you be judged yourself.
Or like speck in your eye when a log.
Judge mine. Not, lest ye be judged yourself.
Don't be so hard on gay people when you have a absolutely disastrous personal life.
That's right. Also,
that's the Bible.
CNN changes their debate rules, and Carly Fiorina could make it onto the debate stage. And then there were 11. And meanwhile, James O'Keefe may have just gasped his last gasp in a massive failure. And also some shocking news about what the words, or I should say what the word Denali means.
Ongawa.
The right wing is really having I don't know. I think it could be this whole Trump thing is causing them to have this massive meltdown. But between that and the Tesla, which we didn't even get to, the poll that shows not just Trump support. I mean, this poll is being misreported in the lead is being buried. Definitely, we will talk about that in terms of Trump and birthers. But my recommendation to these folks would be get some good sleep. And fortunately for them, today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses. They are obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at an incredible price. Now you can get $50 off any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code MAJORITY. Listen, most of you spend about a third of your life sleeping. If you have a child, Matt, and if you have multiple children, then that number is probably close to like 1/15 of the amount of time of your life sleeping. but you should make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies that work together for better nights and brighter days, latex foam and memory foam. So they got just the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. Marin apparently got one of these mattresses. I think they sent him one for free. I did not get that, but he says it's a great mattress. They have a, and this is the amazing thing about this, they've got a risk-free trial and a return policy. They'll deliver it straight to your door. You can try it for 100 days. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it back up. You get to try it for over 3 months. That's crazy. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. Those prices are more than reasonable. And usually you'll spend that on a mattress that you try out for literally 30 seconds. So get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code majority. Terms and conditions apply. So I teased this this poll on Trump, and we'll get to it. But the amazing – let me just do the headline numbers, and I will give you a sense of why I think this thing has been completely misreported. Everybody's tweeting out the fact that 66% of Trump supporters believe Obama is a Muslim. Now – I'm surprised it's only 66%. They also, and only 12% of them believe he's a Christian. 63% favor amending the Constitution to eliminate birthright citizenship. Okay, so that sounds like, oh, well, Trump is just attracting the crazies in the Republican Party. But the reality is this, that same poll also says 51% of the overall GOP electorate wants to eliminate birthright citizenship. 54% of the overall GOP electorate believes that Obama's a Muslim. So the idea that Trump, only 66% of his supporters think that Obama's a Muslim says that he's got room to grow because he's probably the only one out there who's willing to say it. Because 50% of the Republican electorate believe that he is a Muslim, which also means they believe he's a secret Muslim. Because the president has not announced that he's a Muslim. I mean, at least anywhere else but on this show. So it is
exclusive.
It is like unbelievable. That. It is unbelievable. And you're not hearing that. I have been saying from the very beginning that Trump is nothing but a Republican decoder ring. He's not even a mirror to the Republican Party because they don't even realize it. He's just a huge window. He's just delivering the subtext. And now the rest of them are trying to jump on the bandwagon. But we will talk more about that, of course, as the day and the week proceeds. But first, let's talk fantasy football for a minute, because next week, Pats start their season. I don't really care about any other team. Dude.
No fantasy, what we're going to do.
I still haven't heard anything about what is happening with Tom Brady. But here's the thing about this fantasy football league called FanDuel. It's the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and payouts than any other site. So, in other words, you don't have to buy into Tom Brady for the whole season. You can find out when he's doing his suspension and then pick him up. They're paying out over $75 million a week this football season. They have a salary cap format. You can pick any players you want for just 1 week. Entry fees start at just $1, and anyone can play. Go to FanDuel.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use my code MAJOR, as in majority. Sign up now. Special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit on FanDuel, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. Offers only good for the first 50 people that use my code MAJOR today. Don't forget to use the code MAJOR. It's FanDuel.com. Where every day is a new season. That's FANDUEL.com. Sign up today. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. with Professor Harvey K. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Democracy and Justice at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, Professor Harvey K., author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And that book is now out in paperback, I should say. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I have always had a fascination with, and you can characterize it for us, Professor, but with that speech and literally those four freedoms, because they signaled at least an attempt to really change the playing field. Tell us what those four freedoms were.
Yes. By the way, thank you for having me on, Sam. It's a pleasure. I'm a longtime fan. It's great to know that we're on the line together. Okay. Well, FDR, in January 1941, so we're coming up to the 75th anniversary of the speech, went before Congress in what we would call a State of the Union message and warned Americans that the war was not going to pass us by, that the fascists and the imperialists had their eyes on us, and it was essential that we start building a defense industry all the more aggressively, and that we enable the British and their allies to fend off Nazi Germany by turning ourselves into an arsenal of democracy. And then later in the speech, he made it very clear that all of the things that Americans had accomplished during the New Deal should not be abandoned. You know, Republicans and even some conservative Democrats were saying, well, if we're going to, you know, build our defense industries and we're going to, you know, enable Britain to fend off the Nazis, I guess we have to suspend the advances we've made, you know, Social Security, the rights of labor, and so on. And FDR said, absolutely not. All the more reason to build upon those advances, because if you're going to possibly go to war, you're going to have to be healthy and vibrant as a nation. And then, having said it was imperative to continue the advances of the New Deal, he looked ahead, you might say, and he offered a vision of a war, of a world beyond the war, and an America beyond the war. And he articulated, I think he put into words Americans' finest strivings and aspirations, which I think have been pretty much a part of American life going back to the Revolution. And he said the four fundamental freedoms are freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship or freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. So those were the four freedoms that he laid out, and they became, in many ways, the guiding spirit of the war effort, and indeed, even after the war, of the reconstruction of post-war Europe and other parts of the world, and inspired folks, both in America and around the world, to believe that the world after the war was going to be a radically different world than the one that they had suffered so far in the 20th century.
And I want to talk about that the sort of the role of those of those four freedoms in the context of the war. But I want to break down just sort of like, you know, how in many respects it is the freedom from want, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the sort of the was at that time in many respects the most radical. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think freedom from want and freedom from fear were both pretty radical. And I'll tell you why. Okay. By the way, we could even speak about the first two as fairly radical in that day. But I think.
Let's start with that.
Well, first of all, freedom of speech and expression. You know, people said, well, you know, that's in our you know, the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, as well as freedom of worship, freedom of religion. But the main thing to consider is that if people are going to be really free, then it means, and this was very much at the heart of the 30s New Deal and the labor struggles of the decade, it's really important that they be able to organize and defend themselves, which means, for a start, the right to organize unions. I think that's in the speech and expression. And it also implied a participation in government. And clearly in the South, in what we think of as Dixie, African Americans were utterly excluded and beaten upon to keep them out of public life. And then freedom of worship, as much as that would seem to have been a fairly standard American aspiration, let's not forget that right through the 1930s, Catholics and Jews continued to suffer at the hands of, if you like, white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. So there was anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism, which we needed to transcend. But then, and I think you are right, the one that was strikingly radical.
Well, let me just stop on those two.
Yeah.
Let me stop on those two because, you know, we've spoken to folks over the past couple of months about some of the trade-offs that had to happen for the New Deal and some of the horse trading and the sort of the structuring of of the New Deal.
Right. Absolutely. And
that basically, excluded largely, to a large part, women because of certain professions and African Americans and minorities more broadly speaking.
Right.
And in some ways, this is about him still sort of saying, you know, aspirationally, we're still heading in this way.
Right. Oh, and let's not forget, I mean, people too readily discount the New Deal for having excluded people. But in fact, the New Deal initiatives themselves in the laws, those laws were not meant to be applied in any kind of racially or religiously discriminatory fashion.
Right.
But what happened was, in order to make the deals to get the New Deal through in many cases, it afforded the states a level of authority in how they were implemented. So the Roosevelt administration itself, for all of its faults and failings, I don't think virulent racism was ever really a part of that. But it's also the case that when Roosevelt spoke the Four Freedoms, African Americans who already believed that they were included in the New Deal, but they had yet to benefit effectively from it, they thought that he was speaking to them as much as to anyone. So I'll just add, for example, and we're jumping a little bit away, that A. Philip Randolph heard that speech and saw this as the great opportunity of demanding, to some extent, the integration of the military and the integration of the war industries. Okay, so that just, you know, there's that struggle is underway, and Roosevelt was not averse to enhancing that struggle. Which brings us then to the freedom from want and fear. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay, so freedom from want and fear. Many a reporter, a liberal reporter, you might say, and even Eleanor Roosevelt herself noted that when he spoke of freedom from want and fear, that basically she saw Republicans and Southern Democrats sitting on their hands, not applauding that as strenuously as they may well have applauded the early part of the speech. And why? Well, freedom from want implied a radical expansion of the New Deal, okay? And also it implied, once again, the capacity of labor to organize and to organize effectively enough to raise the wages of working people. The other thing is, and this is critical, is that freedom from fear, you can imagine how it scared Southern Democrats, the white supremacist Southern Democrats, because they knew full well that freedom from Mir meant that the federal government might finally take action in enforcing what civil rights legislation was already on the books. And this is an important footnote to all of this. In 1940, the Department of Justice created a civil liberties unit, which eventually I think it basically becomes a civil rights unit. And they were determined to prosecute Southern landowners and officials who were turning Southern sharecroppers, black Southern sharecroppers, into peons, you know, into basically indebted bondage. So, I mean, when they heard those, they were not terribly inspired. They got a little worried that, in fact, the Roosevelt administration, even as we prepared for war, was going to take action to enhance American democracy.
And so give me a sense, I mean, because when you're talking about freedom from want, right, this is different from freedom of opportunity. This is basically saying that everyone should have a basic level of, I mean, even maybe beyond basic, right? I mean, because freedom from need, it's freedom from want.
One of the things that's very interesting about Roosevelt is that he actually had begun to speak in these terms in 1932 before he was even elected. People generally haven't paid enough attention to his campaign speeches in 1932, where he actually says that the United States has long suffered, I'll paraphrase, the rule by the 1%. And in essence, what we need to do is go back to the Declaration of Independence and now create an economic declaration of rights, which would begin to provide economic security to all Americans, not simply to those who have wealth and power. And then in 1941, with the Four Freedoms speech, he really articulates it in a way that speaks directly, and he spoke nationally and internationally when he spoke. It really did inspire people to take action. And then the punchline to prove that all those people who were afraid of him were right is in 1944, he gives another State of the Union message where he calls for an economic bill of rights, which then is exactly what you're referring to. It would be the guarantee, you might say, a guarantee of a job, guaranteed of food, clothing, and shelter, guarantee of national health care. And to add to that, Roosevelt knew, they had done surveys in 1944 where 85% of Americans wanted to create a social democratic America. They wanted to guarantee higher education. They wanted to guarantee health care. They wanted to make sure that Americans were housed and fed. They wanted to guarantee a job. Can you imagine? 85% of Americans were ready to go in a dramatic social democratic direction.
And how was it reported at the time? In other words, like, you know, when you talk about freedom from fear, right? I mean, this could be interpreted two different ways to those people at the time who did not have to sort of worry about the idea of domestic fear, right? Like, I have there may be some measure of crime, but in the main, I can go outside my house, I can walk down the street, there's no parts of town that I can't go to, there's no, the police are always there for me. If you are a black person at the time, or some other, minority, you have this sense of, like, there are times if I say the wrong thing to the wrong person, they can hurt me with impunity on some level.
Absolutely.
How is this reported, though? Like, when the mainstream, when the press talks about, because I can see freedom of speech, freedom of religion, these are at least aspirational things that were out there. But the freedom from want and the freedom from fear is a slightly different sort of articulation. How was that reported at the time?
Well, that's a good question. And in fact, the response on the part of the liberal side of the media, the liberal press, and magazines like the then very liberal New Republic and The Nation, they welcomed these words. There was no question about it. And they reported this as both a national and international question. So in other words, when they reported it, they had in mind, keep in mind, that elderly Jewish people and young and kids were getting beaten up by right-wing groups in Boston and in Brooklyn. Down south, don't forget, this was the age still of lynching in the South. So when the reports were made, people grasped hold of this, and even in the liberal media, as a sign, because of what Roosevelt had said just before announcing them, that this was going to mean an expansion of these New Deal democratic initiatives, and these freedoms would actually have a significant effect on American life. Now, more often the report was as if the United States, and this is what worried a lot of Republicans, that the United States was going to find its way into World War II. By the way, the Republicans were isolationists at that time, not the Democrats.
Right.
The Republicans were isolationists. So when it came to the everyday life kinds of things, I don't think it actually was reported directly in that way, but people heard it in that way, and many a columnist translated it into those kinds of things. And I'll add that what really then brings it home, even though they've been a little belittled because of their role in advertising all these years, is when artists translated the Four Freedoms into images. And the most famous images are, of course, Norman Rockwell's paintings, The Four Freedoms. But those had a tremendous impact on people's imaginations. Rockwell, by the way, in case people don't remember, there's that famous image, the iconic image of the auto mechanic in a Vermont town hall meeting, standing up and speaking, and all the men and women around him who are dressed in shirt and tie and in dresses are paying close attention to what he has to say. So the image in most people's minds is that this freedom of speech was itself a fundamental. And as I said, people did organize in response to this speech.
Right. You talk about that because, I mean, you there was literally, I mean, I think you talk about the American Junior League.
The women's organization immediately organized into volunteer associations to make the Four Freedoms real, even in everyday life in their own communities. The A. Philip Randolph organized the original March on Washington movement to try to bring what he first thought would be 10,000 and eventually projected 100,000 African Americans to D.C. to protest the segregation in the military and in the war industries. And Roosevelt and Randolph did meet, and Roosevelt issued an executive order saying that defense industries had to open up opportunities for African Americans. As well, progressives of the day started organizing democracy schools in cities around the country. I mean, it mattered to Americans that we had yet to achieve these four freedoms. Oh, and I can tell you that when the end of the war came, a lot of those GIs who too many historians dismiss as having little interest in the ideas of the Four Freedoms, they had every expectation that they were going to come back, both the men and the women, and they were going to build a nation characterized by those Four Freedoms.
And to a certain extent, I mean, I think you cited, I think it was some polling that there was a sense, at the very least amongst African-American soldiers at the time, that the war was sort of about those freedoms, right?
Oh,
it wasn't.
Yes, right.
Okay, talk about that. Just
black newspapers in the United States came out in favor of the war effort and announced what was called the movement for the double victory, the double V. And the idea was, yes, we're solidly behind the war effort. We know what Nazism and fascism means racially. But we also know that we have to fight fascism here in America, most especially down south where white supremacy prevailed, but equally up north in terms of the political and economic and cultural segregation. And so there was a commitment to the war, but as they said, this was a struggle for the double victory. Langston Hughes put it, I like those four freedoms. I like them for not only you, but I like them for me too. I mean, something like that. I created a rhyme out of a finer rhyme of his. But this mattered. And by the way, when they came home, Southern black GIs went out and organized veterans groups to go out and register Southern blacks to vote. And they did actually sign up a million, by 1950, a million Southern blacks were registered to vote, though unfortunately they were prevented from voting. But when these black GIs went through their communities and knocked on doors to get people to come out to vote, they said, look, I fought for those four freedoms overseas. It's time for you to join me and push for the four freedoms here in America.
And so let's talk about, I mean, you know, we have these sort of this this language, which works both for sort of aspirational, and it also worked at the time, I think, it sort of motivationally and, as a rallying cry. What happens then?
I
want to take us through sort of the evolution, or maybe perhaps the devolution, to when Reagan talks about his economic freedoms, like the pushback from the right.
Okay, well, the pushback from the right begins even during the war. Now, conservatives and the corporate elite knew that they couldn't directly attack the idea of the four freedoms because the overwhelming majority of Americans had already embraced it. So it was a fairly clear initiative on their part. They said you can't have the four freedoms without a fifth freedom, private enterprise. And over again, they promoted this, and they spent a lot of money doing it. After the war, by the way, most Americans didn't buy into the essential need for a fifth freedom of enterprise. But after the war, they spent, the conservatives and corporate elite, they spent millions and tens of millions of dollars in the media, in radio programming, in every fashion, in advertising, to try to redirect the American aspirations. After the war, there was created something that was originally meant to celebrate the victory over fascism and became more of a rallying cry to fight communism, known as the Freedom Train, which traveled around the country. And would you believe that on the Freedom Train, once the business community took it over as a project, they had none of the major victories of the New Deal included on the train's exhibitions. Nor did they include the four freedoms, other than by way of freedom of speech and freedom of worship. So it was fairly clear the business community, they were ready to, in essence, suppress the memory of those four freedoms. However, Americans themselves didn't necessarily forget it. And by the way, a lot of people don't realize that even through the late 40s, right through the 50s, a majority of Americans, not an overwhelming majority, but a majority of Americans still wanted national health care. And let's not forget, one of every three American workers was in a labor union at the time. And let's not forget that the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, had organized nearly 500,000 blacks during the war who were ready to fight for civil rights after the war, as well as the Congress of Racial Equality. So, you know, the post-war period through the 50s, we shouldn't underestimate the dynamism below the surface. We should ignore 1950s Hollywood renditions, okay?
I'm looking for audio to play for our Labor Day show, and watched an interview with Walter Reuther, arguing as to why auto workers on the line should be sharing in the profits in the same way that the CEO was, because the CEO is not the owner. They're an employee, technically, yet they get massive bonuses. He was saying some of that should come to the workers because they're as responsible for the profits as much, or at least to some degree, I mean, arguably, just in principle, as the CEO. There was quite a bit of pushback on that, but it was interesting to see that even that conversation happen in that manner on TV at the time.
Yes. You know, as long as you brought that up, this is an interesting thing that a lot of people don't realize. The labor unions were very strong after World War II. I mean, again, one of every three workers was essentially organized. And labor at the time did not really want to fight for enhanced benefits for workers. Most labor unions were committed to fighting for national health care and national benefits. When finally the United Auto Workers agreed to a contract that was going to radically enhance their health care coverage and things like that, that was a sign that they realized that they could not succeed in securing national health care for all Americans.
Right.
So, I mean, labor was solidly committed to that social democratic project that Roosevelt had helped initiate with their support. And seriously speaking, we should never underestimate the degree to which the Roosevelt administration empowers labor to organize and to continue the fight against big capital.
But then we should say also that in 1947, you have the Taft-Hartley Act, which in many respects was sort of the arguably, sort of the slow moving death punch, right? I mean,
yes. Oh, absolutely.
That kung fu move where you punch the guy in the kidney and 3 weeks later he dies or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Now, labor was poised to expand, and they knew that the only way they would really grow after the war was to head south, to break up the white supremacy and corporate control of the South. And what the Taft-Hartley Act did is it licensed Southern states to pass right-to-work laws that blocked labor's capacity to organize unions in the South, which might well have been biracial unions. I know it sounds fantastic, and we would have seen a different America, I'm convinced, in the ensuing decades.
So, all right, so let's talk about the pushback there, because I think, you know, when we talk about the success, I should say, of the pushback by corporate powers, by the free marketeers,
right,
we usually date that starting in the early 70s. But it was happening through the 40s, obviously, the 50s.
Yeah.
From the moment that the New Deal was passed, the Republican platform was calling it socialism, communism,
right,
and saying it was problematic. Yeah. So they, in some respects, I mean, Reagan, I want to jump ahead a little bit because we're
yes,
heading
I'm
towards
fair.
The time. But
Reagan, of course, was a member of that Greatest Generation. And he had been an avid supporter of Roosevelt and an avid supporter of Truman. But in the course of the 1950s, he moved to the right. And he became, of course, a spokesperson, a leading spokesperson of the right and for big business against the legacy of the New Deal, attacking Social Security, attacking the Tennessee Valley Authority, you know, the big projects down south. I mean,
narrating anti-union films, I guess, at the time.
Right, even as he himself headed up the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about bizarre, right? So when he wins the presidency, when he runs for the presidency in the 1970s, he is himself trying to temper his language, because he knows Americans will not vote against someone who is attacking Roosevelt. So basically he redirects his attack a bit towards the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson. And then, however, when he's in office, it's fascinating, he tries to turn the language, the rhetoric, the vision of Roosevelt upside down. So he wants to create, he says in 1987, he gives this speech at the Jefferson Memorial on July 3rd, 1987, sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce, not surprisingly, where he's going to create an economic bill of rights. And in this economic bill of rights, instead of guaranteeing Americans their rights and guaranteeing Americans their needs, Roosevelt said, necessitous men are not free men. What Reagan does is he turns it upside down, and he talks about guaranteeing profits, lowering taxes. I mean, it's literally turning Roosevelt's idea of the Four Freedoms and Economic Bill of Rights inside out. I mean, that's the kind of thing that takes place. And by the way, even today, conservatives directly attack FDR's Four Freedoms. Jim DeMint, who was the U.S. Senator from South Carolina and now the head of the Heritage Foundation,
right,
he has written books in which he makes it a point of attacking freedom from one head on. Ron Paul, right, the father of Rand Paul, who was for many years in Congress, he actually has a chapter in one of his recent books which denigrates craps all over the idea of the Four Freedoms. I mean, conservatives to this day have in their heads that they're going to undo the New Deal, and you and I both know that this is a class war from above that's been going on for 40 years.
I mean, really, in terms of the New Deal, that it's been going on for 80 now, I guess. And I mean, it's interesting, too, because the pushback started relatively early when I think it was the Chamber of Commerce came up with a fifth freedom. Right. Which was
right, private enterprise. Right.
Yes. I mean,
that's
this
right.
is fascinating to me when, you know, the idea that Reagan would attempt, I mean, because I mean, this is a little bit far afield, but the idea that Reagan would attempt to address the idea of those four freedoms and the Economic Bill of Rights that, you know, but supplant them with, it was freedom to work, freedom to enjoy the fruits of one's labor. In other words, freedom to spend a lot of money,
right?
And freedom to work, of course, means I don't have to join a union. The freedom to own and control one's property. In other words, you can't tell me I have to serve black people. And the freedom to participate in a free market, which, of course, again, means, you know, child labor laws, you know, minimum wage, whatever you want to talk about are all wrong. The idea, I mean, the reason why I'm hitting on this so importantly is to communicate just how important it is perceived by political leaders to undo even those things that were aspirational and are rhetorical in many respects.
Yes. Right.
Because that's where it launches from.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. And by the way, I mean, Reagan was an artist at doing just that kind of thing. My previous book to the Four Freedoms book was about Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And actually opened with Reagan's speech in 1980 to the Republican National Convention accepting the nomination. And what's fascinating there is he quotes three great Americans, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Paine, and Franklin Roosevelt. And he shocked the Republican delegates because the one Republican they didn't want to know anymore was Abraham Lincoln. The one radical from the Revolution they would have nothing to do with for 200 years, they hated his guts, was Thomas Paine, and you know how much they despised Roosevelt. So what Reagan does is he literally grabs hold of these three figures because he knows he's got the nomination. He wants to talk to the American people now, and he knows that every American loves Lincoln, has a firm affection for Thomas Paine, and will never give up their affection for Franklin Roosevelt. And he's beginning to figure out a way to turn them upside down and inside out.
And, you know, it's fascinating because the thing that occurs to me is just that time when, and this is, again, a little far afield, but when Barack Obama said that the thing that he admired about Ronald Reagan was his ability to sort of redefine.
Right.
And, you know, I think to a large extent, that was one of, and I would say there's several, but one of the greatest unfulfilled promises, I think, of President Obama is that he did not rhetorically begin to chip away and reinterpret those, you know, even Ronald Reagan on some level, right?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. And in fact, when he said that, you may recall that liberals and progressives and people on the left were outraged that he would have this kind of admiration for what Reagan accomplished. What he should have then said is, now we're going to do it, and he should have proceeded to do that. You know, when he was inaugurated, you probably remember that great day in 2009, 2 million people out on the National Mall, he had an opportunity to begin to turn the tide on the what then was 30 plus years of Republican conservative ascendance, in part by saying, not just using the words of Thomas Paine. By the way, I don't know if everyone knows that he actually quotes Thomas Paine in his inaugural address, Obama, which I thought, oh wow, he's going to undo the damage Reagan did. But he never used Paine's name. It was like he was running from the radicalism of Tom Paine by never using his name, which was unfortunate. Huh. And I think we've seen that for the last 7 years.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and it is now out in paperback. The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, Professor Harvey Kay, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. I hope we get to sit down face-to-face someday.
Yes, I'd like that very much. Thank you
Great.
So much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, I'm using a Fire RTC today to place the call, because that has been a little bit more stable as of late.
Sounded really good.
The only problem is now I missed the boop, boop. I could talk to my buddy, see if he can put that in. See if he can put that in. It's firertc.com, folks, to sign up. I use it through Chrome, and it's just like, it's basically like Skype. But it's, you call right through it, and there's some other features that Skype doesn't seem to have. But I quite like it. Great book. Fight for the Four Freedoms. That speech has always been, in fact, I don't know if I included that on the Labor Day speech that we were doing. But I think I'm going to include that Walter Reuther interview. I mean, it was interesting. I'm trying to track down. I mean, here's the dilemma, and I should tell you, that just folks, to give you a sense of what's going to happen over the next couple of days, because it's going to rock your world. Tomorrow, we're going to be doing pre-tapes for the next 3 days. Tomorrow, and it's all new to you, and most of you listen via podcast anyways. So tomorrow on the program, I do an omnibus interview with David Dayan, who's written three pieces that I wanted to discuss with him. And each one on their own were not quite long enough to sustain an extended interview. But I wanted to talk to him before the end of the summer. So we interviewed him. And by we, of course, I mean me. But Matt was working the audio dials. So that's why I say we. And sure. We also interviewed Harold Pollack. He is a professor of Social Services Administration, University of Chicago, on, and this is so exciting to me. And
Sam,
I think
was so giddy during this. Like, you have no, you have to listen to this interview.
I was excited during the interview. I was excited at the idea that I could do the interview. It was all very exciting to me. On Social Security disability insurance. Look, the bottom line is the right. That we're going to hear a lot about this in the coming months. And they already started in, and you've already seen, like, you know, 60 Minutes do a report claiming that there's rampant fraud and blah, blah, blah. Bull crap. And you will have a better foundation to talk about Social Security disability insurance than any other single audience of an audio or video program in the country. I wish I had something. You know what I really needed? Was I needed the bum-bum. The, oh, my gosh. That's where that came from. On Law & Order. The end of this Perry Mason thing. No? All right.
No.
No, sorry. But that is the case. And that'll be the program tomorrow. And then Cliff and I will pre-tape for Friday. And then on Monday, I am trying to mix it up. And I think I'll be able to mix it up a little bit from our typical Labor Day speech show. On that show, I had a speech from John Lewis. I think one from FDR. One from, I can't remember. I can't remember the other ones. I'm going to try and mix it up. Maybe we'll include one. And I'm trying to find a John Lewis speech, a famous John Lewis speech that Rich Yselson has recommended. So we will see. But the hard part is that a lot of these, I mean, I wanted to try and find a speech from Philip Randolph. I don't know if he gave any good speeches. I don't know. It's very hard to find good audio speeches of labor leaders. I don't know why. I mean, it's probably hard to find a lot of speeches audio, but
they needed to up their social media game.
Yes, back in the 30s, yes, and the 20s and the 40s. All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. Hey, folks, you can support this program by becoming a member today. We had a very lucky week this week where we had an ad. Well, we were supposed to have one Monday, but somebody dropped the ball. But we would have had an ad each day this week, which would have been great.
Really nice.
That would have been great.
Wouldn't have been good.
Yes.
Just so reflect on that.
Instead, what we're going to do is be working in the dark for a day and make up. You're going to have to power your own computer with some type of little generator or something like this.
I can't see Will Both.
How is it me that did it?
No, that's just the, well, wow. That's just the generic.
No, that's definitely the Matt office phone.
Well, all right.
Ooh, there's a little, maybe the lady doth protest too much.
Or not enough. Folks, your support is still needed. become a member today at Majority Report. Join the MajorityReport.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority, get 10% off. Great coffee, great sponsor, great policies in terms of paying their workers. And if you buy crap from Amazon, not so great policies, but if you buy crap from Amazon, I understand it's convenient for people, blah, blah, blah. The least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. We skim a little money off of Jeff Bezos's top, as it were. Oof. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me. Pick up the app at majorityapp.com. See you on the flip side.